This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatto. Spring. It's the time to stroll through your garden and enjoy the blooming flowers and sprouting fruits and the veggies. But like many growers, like me, you may have let your garden go, let it go during these cold winter months. Now, the first step is bringing your soils back. You know that as a gardener. And my next guest says soil is an ecosystem unto itself. He's here to fill us in on some soil science and tell us how we can read the profile of our clays and silts just by looking at them. David Linbow is the director of the Soil Science Division at the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Natural Resources Conservation Service. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you for having me.
Let's talk about the difference. I know this is going to sound weird because everybody wants to know between dirt and soil. People sort of mix the two up, don't they?
They do. We always say dirt is the stuff that's under your fingernails. Dirt's the stuff you sweep off the floor. Soil, on the other hand, is way more than that. It's one of the four things you can't live without: water, air, sunlight, and soil. All of our food comes from soil. All of our clothing comes from soil. So all of our houses, our structures. So without soil, you would be hungry, homeless, and naked.
No, I know. I understand that each state has a state soil. I really didn't realize there were so many classes of soil. How does a soil form differently, and why are there so many different types?
Well, soil represents where it formed. It forms based on its climate, how long it's been there, the organisms that live in it and interact with it, the relief where it is on the landscape, and the parent material. So just like we have parents, soils have parents too. So it's a mixture of all those five things that help soil or make soil the way it is.
Mm. All right, I'm going out of my garden now. It's springtime. I want to assess the state of my soil. Now, what should I do?
Okay, several things. One is just take a handful of it. Smell it. It should smell earthy, kind of sweet, not sour. So smell really does tell you a lot about the soil. It should crumble easily. If you dig it and it comes out as a block, it's maybe compacted. You can also determine if it's compacted by just sticking a flag or a coat hanger into it. And if it resists, you have some compaction. Feel what it's like. Is it really sandy? May need to add more organic matter. If it has too much clay and it's too sticky, again, organic matter can help a great deal. If it feels smooth and makes a nice ribbon about, say, an inch to 2 inches long, that's a loam, and that's a great place to be for your garden. Mm-hmm. Also, look at the color. If it's not real dark, you probably don't have a lot of organic matter, and organic matter can really help your garden. The more you can add, the better off you are.
Mm-hmm. We've had a lot of rain here in the soil. It can still be very wet. Should we wait for it to dry out a bit before?
A little. You don't want to work the soil when it is too wet. That can destroy the structure, and the structure is how the individual particles of sand, silt, and clay are arranged. If you break the structure up, you can smear the soil, puddle the soil, and that can actually cause problems and increase the amount of compaction that you have in the soil.
Mm-hmm.
Don't work it when it's too wet.
Don't work it. And if you have very compact, compressed soil, should you dig it up? Should you till it or aerate it?
Aerating it a little bit is fine, but you don't want to work the soil too much. It's kind of counterintuitive. Tilling the soil and trying to break it up mechanically can actually cause more damage to it. What you want to do is add organic matter and just gently work that in. The microbes and the organisms that live in the soil will start to create aggregates, which is exactly what you want in the soil.
So if you till it too much, you're basically breaking up the microbiome that's in the soil.
In some ways, it's kind of like if you have a bowl of granola, you can add some milk to it and it stays, pretty crunchy. But if you took that granola and crushed it before you added the milk and then added the milk, you end up with mush. And you don't want that in the soil. You want the soil to have good, strong aggregates. It allows the roots to penetrate. It allows water to drain. And you don't want your roots to be waterlogged. You want a nice mixture of air and water present.
All right. Now we've got our basics down. We've gone to the shops to buy our plants. Now we're digging our hole. It sounds kind of pretty basic. Like lots of people, they dig a hole, they may pat and compact the walls of the hole, make it a little bit more stable. Is there a right way and a wrong way to dig a hole and fill it in?
Well, the way you just described it is the absolute wrong way to do it. Think of the
explains my gardening a little.
Yeah. Okay. So what you want to do is dig a hole, and we say, yeah, if you have a $5 plant, you want a $20 hole. The time that you spend preparing it will be beneficial. Go in, dig the hole out, make sure that the edges of the hole are broken up. They're not smeared. That allows the roots to be able to get into the hole, allows water to get out of the soil as well as back in, and your plant will be much happier. Also, adding some compost to the bottom of the hole to make sure that you don't put the plant in too deep so that it's in there good. Mm. And then at the end, you don't have to pat down around it. A little bit of a ridge around the edge of the hole to trap some water would be great, but don't pat it down. You've just kind of destroyed what you've just
done. See, because I always has heard you should pat down the plant so that the roots make good contact with the soil.
You do need to make sure that there's contact by watering it afterwards. Mm. That allows the structure, that allows the soil to settle a little bit, and that'll give you the good structure.
All right,
so be gentle.
Now let's go to Esther in Charlottesville, Virginia. Hi, Esther.
Hi.
Hi there.
My question was, I have a lot of red clay in my yard, so it's really hard to get anything to grow just because there isn't a lot of nutrients and it's super, super packed down. What would you suggest to do in a situation like that?
Adding organic matter, compost, work it in. Again, don't over-till, but just work it in with a tilling fork would be the best thing that you can do. And you need to do this over time. One application is not going to be enough for you. This is a constant process to rebuild the microbes in the soil. The organic matter will benefit you for years to come. This is how we can make the soil healthier.
Thanks for calling. And we have a follow-up to that. We have a tweet from Happy Bees 2 who says, the clay soil in my garden stains my hands, leaves a dry residue that stays through multiple soap washes. What's up with that?
That's just iron oxides. A lot of times the red soil, the red color that you see is coatings on the particles, and that is simply iron oxide coatings. It's kind of like paint. Mm-hmm. And yes, it will stain your fingers.
And a tweet from Cindy McCammon says, I've left potting soil in a bucket, pretty much enclosed in a garbage bag on my south-facing balcony. Have I killed helpful organisms?
You may have changed them a little bit, but no, you haven't killed them. As soon as you put that back out in the garden, there are millions, billions of microbes that will just keep growing. It's organic, so they'll be eating whatever's in that potting soil.
Do you have a favorite soil type, one that's really interesting to you?
My research when I worked on my doctorate was on frangipans, and that's so that's still the soils that I like to see. They're difficult to understand, very difficult to dig, but I've always enjoyed working
with
them.
Well, what is that, Joe?
And they're colorful.
Explain that. What is that?
So a frangipan is a horizon in the soil that appears to be cemented, but it really isn't. When it gets wet, it's you can dig through it. As it dries out a little bit, it gets very brittle. It prevents water from moving through, and it also prevents roots from moving through. So not good if you're gardening. But it's interesting to look at how it's formed, why it's present, and then how to manage it.
Mm. Let's say you have, I mentioned the wet soil before. Mm-hmm. Let's say you have very dry soil. Can you just water it back to health?
No, not necessarily. If it's a dry soil or a soil that is very droughty, that drains quickly like sand, just by watering it really won't change it. Again, adding organic matter. Maybe I sound like a broken record, but organic matter does an awful lot to really help improve the soil and improve the soil health. Mm. So that's the best thing you can do to it is add organic matter.
Do you hear a lot about peats and loams and silty soils? What are those? What's the difference between them?
Well, when you say peat, we're referring to organic matter. And a specific, for a soil scientist, a peat is a very specific type of organic matter in terms of how decomposed it is. We have peats, mucky peats, and mucks. Peat is the least decomposed. You can still look at it and see that it was plant material. A muck, on the other hand, you can't tell really what it was. It looks like muck. When you say loam, that is one of the 12 textures that USDA uses to describe soils. And a texture is simply the percent sand, silt, and clay, and actually has nothing to do with the organic matter that's present.
Hmm.
So texture is, again, no organic matter. Adding organic matter will, again, help the soil.
I see. That's sort of like a mantra, isn't it? Can you have too much organic matter?
You can, in as far as if it's a truly organic soil, there are certain properties that will be a little difficult to manage. As far as stability, very organic soils are not as strong, so trying to work them or walk across them, you can sink into them. Equipment has some problems with it. But organic soils, when properly managed, can indeed be some of the most fertile soils that we have.
You don't want to plant into all compost, do you? Just stick stuff into compost.
You can, but the stability that you get from the mineral material, some of the nutrients that are still there, are beneficial.
Well, thank you very much, David. You've given us a little running start. We're getting our hands dirty this spring. We love it. Thank you very much,
David. Good luck with your garden.
Thank you. I need it. David Linbow is director of the Soil Science Division of the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Natural Resources Conservation Service. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to stay on the theme of gardening. Rebecca Louie is founder of the blog Compost S and author of Compost City, practical composting know-how for small space living. You don't have a big backyard. You want to work inside your small apartment. We'll tell you how to create your own soil with composting, including bin worms. Yeah, that's popular stuff. We'll stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Around New York City, little brown compost bins have started to appear in different neighborhoods, which has made composting nerds around the city very happy. And I can see my next guest is already giving me a high five on that. But there are many ways for do-it-yourself composting, and you don't even need a backyard to do it. We even had a Science Friday office compost bin way back in the day. But for you pro composters, or if you're just starting out, you might have some questions. Is your bin too hot? What is worm tea good for? And what can you compost in a studio apartment? My next guest is here to break down the how-tos of composting. Rebecca Louie is a master composter. She's also founder of the blog Compost S and author of Compost City, Practical Composting Know-How for Small Space Living. She's based out here in New York, and she's in our CUNY studios. Welcome.
Thank you. I'm so glad to be here.
And for everybody who has a composting question, you can give us a call, 844-724-8255. You can also tweet us at SciFry. How long have you been at this composting?
It's been a fun-filled decade, I think, about now, yeah.
And let's talk about this. How easy is it for someone in an apartment to do this?
So I think the perception is that, like, composting has to be this, like, little house on the prairie, sweaty thing that takes space and outdoors, et cetera. But actually, there are several systems that can be adapted to small spaces and indoor spaces. So if you don't have a yard, even if you don't have a window box, you can do it.
All right, let's get right to the ABCs of this. What do we need? How do we start?
Okay, well, first, you need to start with the basic understanding of what you're doing, right? So there's a balance that happens in any compost system, your dry stuff and your wet stuff. Dry is like leaves, paper, etc., cardboard. Your wet stuff is your food scraps. Every system has its own special balance. So in an apartment, you could have a worm bin. We've got some worms here with us today.
Cute.
Yeah, cute little guys. Worm bins live in like an enclosed space, like a storage tote, a bucket. There are commercial systems you could buy as well. Mm-hmm. The brown dry stuff, the carbon layer, is the bedding that they live in. You fill up the bedding, you dampen it, and you marry it with your food scraps. The worms go in, they eat slowly, they turn it all to black gold.
It's just like an egg carton, a shredded egg carton,
you
it
can
looks
do,
like.
Yep, egg cartons. There's maybe some paper towel rolls in there, shredded paper, newspaper. As long as you're not doing waxy items like a cereal box or a magazine, you're in good shape.
Mm-hmm. And you can buy the worms online or?
Yep, where? You buy the worms online. You can actually buy them in New York City at the Union Square Green Market from the Lower East Side Ecology Center. But it's a specific species. So some people ask, oh, can I go dig out the worms or pick them off the sidewalk after a rain? Probably not. These are red wigglers. They're perfect for enclosed spaces. They eat a ton. They reproduce like mad, and they don't want to go anywhere. So they love living in that bin.
And they don't smell at all.
Yeah, what does it smell like in there?
It smells like earth.
Yes.
Yes, smells like the good earth.
Eau de earth.
It is a great smell. All right, let's talk about if you have the room in your backyard and you want to do some composting. How do we do that?
Sure. Well, especially in a city scenario, you have to think, okay, I've got neighbors. Maybe we have to be careful about how we do this. So discretion is often important, right? Something that I love is the digester, which is some sort of container with holes drilled in the bottom half that's buried underground. You bury most of it. The lid is open, is on top that you can close and open as needed. Mm-hmm. And essentially, those holes end up being passageways for microbes and earthworms, et cetera, to come and eat your food scraps.
Mm-hmm. And what do you put in there? Is there a rule for what to put in and what not to put in?
So digesters are super forgiving. You can put a lot of green material, which is that sort of wet, food scrappy things. But a big consideration is, of course, meat, dairy, cooked food, all those gnarly things when, like, they're breaking down in your garbage. You know it's a bad scene. So if it's outside in the yard, call all the rats. I will say there's a really exciting solution, which is the fermentation of food waste, which can happen for any type of food waste, your old wine, your old leftovers, whatever. You dump it in, you ferment it in an anaerobic bin with special microbes, and then you can bury it anywhere in soil.
So it has to be, I know, like when I ferment my pickles, it has to be underwater, out of the air, basically.
Right. So it's just, in a bucket, an airtight bucket. Yep.
Let's get to, we have people who need advice. Let's go to Lisa in Savuna Park, Maryland. Hi, Lisa. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi.
Hi there.
Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you. Go ahead.
Hi. Great. I just want to say I love Science Friday, and this topic is right up my alley. I've wanted to do composting for a long time, and finally for Earth Day this year, I went to our county, and they gave me this big plastic thing that becomes a compost bin. And my question has to do with where to put it, because we have a very small yard, which is mostly shaded by my neighbor's trees. And the instructions said, oh, put it in a sunny location. So I haven't put it up yet, because I'm sort of not sure what to do with it.
So the exciting thing is you do not have to stress out, really, about where you put it. The reason they recommend it's in a sunny location is because heat often accelerates bacterial activity and breaks things down faster. So if you're in some sort of like epic rush to get the compost now, maybe find a patch of sun. But what's really great about composting is that it's a flexible lifestyle. So you can stick it anywhere it's convenient. If there's a bottom on there, you have a little bit more, you have more choices because you could put it on a patio, you could put it on concrete. But if it has an open bottom and can drain directly into the soil below it, put it anywhere. Don't be super concerned about the sun.
Good luck to you. So you can make it out of any crate you have in the backyard? Or?
Yeah, one of my favorite things to do is a bucket composting boot camp, which is essentially taking a 5-gallon bucket, which you can get for free,
right,
or you can get, you know, for a few bucks at the local hardware store. And essentially, if you have a drill and you have determination, you can do it really easily. They can all be adapted because all they are closed containers with holes for air and moisture to leach out of, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And do you have to turn it over or during the...
You can. So, you know, I'm of a very big, like, lifestyle, see what fits for you. You can. By turning things, you're mixing air, you're mixing microbes, you're mixing moisture, and you're facilitating the process. But if you're lazy, or I'm sorry, if you're relaxed, if you have any, like, physical constraints where you can't necessarily turn something that is getting heavy with scraps, you don't have to. There's certain tools like tumblers that are designed to roll and mix with like the help of a crank, or it's the shape of a wheel and you roll it down the sidewalk. And you can do that with a bucket. Turn a 5-gallon bucket on its side, roll it, you know, down the sidewalk, and you've got your DIY tumbler.
What's this method you call lasagna composting?
Oh, it makes me think of lasagna. It's so exciting. It's just layers and layers of all the good stuff that equal compost. So what I love about lasagna gardening, especially for small spaces, is that you can be strategic. Let's say you have like a raised bed outside that you're trying to fill up, right? You put your layer of browns, again, your paper, your leaves, your cardboard, shredded, you know, increased surface area, microbe activity, blah, blah, blah. You put your browns, you put a layer of greens, then you might put a layer of already existing soil, which then inoculates kind of the world around it with the microbes and the goodies. And you just keep going, lasagna, 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 layers after layers. And in time, it decomposes, and you've got an amazing raised bed full of good soil.
Wow, let's go to the phones. Let's go to our nation's capital, Kelsey in Washington. Hi, welcome.
Hi, I have a small stainless steel composting like countertop bin, and I use mostly fruit scraps and eggshells, and my bin got maggots. So I'm wondering what I did wrong and if I can save it.
Did you put any meat or anything in there or no? And does it have a lid with a screen of some sort?
It does. It has like a charcoal filter built into the lid, and I might not have been as diligent as I should have been with washing my eggshells.
Okay, well, the function of those kind of countertop bins is not so much to have the composting happen in it, but to be sort of like a holding vessel, right, so that you carry your compost outside or to whatever system you use. One thing you could do is that if you plan to keep things on there for a long time is to freeze your scraps before you put them in. Freezing is a great way to kill pest eggs and all sorts of other things that are on the surfaces of the food that you have, so that if you wanted to place it back in the bin after freezing it, there's less of a likelihood that you'd have some sort of bloom.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you so much.
Thank you, Kelsey. Just a reminder, if you're joining us, we're talking composting with Rebecca Louie, author of Compost City, Practical Composting, Know-How for a Small Space Living, from the kitchen counter to community composting and beyond. Lots of the phones are lighting up about compost. Let's go to Alan in San Francisco. Hi, Alan.
I am looking at about 20 fruit flies on my little composting bin here. We've got mandatory composting, which I think is great, but my kitchen periodically breaks out with masses of fruit flies. Is there any way to get rid of them other than spraying my whole kitchen?
Yeah, don't spray your kitchen. There's a really easy fix. If you take some apple cider vinegar and pour it into a bottle and leave the top open, thus creating kind of like a narrow entryway at the top of a bottle and then like a whole, you know, world inside the bottle, the fruit flies mm-hmm. will actually be naturally attracted to it. There's sort of some adaptations you can do to ensure that like the flies don't fly right back out the top. You can create a cone out of paper. They fly into the cone. They can't get back out because the cone is expanded in the hole of the bottle. But that's a really great way to do it. In addition, there are like tapes, like fly tapes that you could put up. And there's sort of a range. Some are see-through, some are thick and fat, some are like swirly, like whatever aesthetic works mm-hmm. best for you. You can tape up those flies as well.
All right. Thanks for calling. Hope that works for you. What's the number one newbie fail when it comes?
All right. So the fail comes to messing up that recipe, right? That relationship between the greens and browns. Everyone has tons of food scraps and they don't think about like the dry carbon-based material. So they're like, yay, I just made a dinner for four vegetarians. I'm going to just put it all in there and it's going to compost. But it won't do it right unless you add the carbon dry materials. It soaks up the water. It creates the right balance inside, the right home for microbes, etc. And what results is sort of like the disaster compost story. It stinks. Oh, it's mucky. It's like creatures are jumping out at me. And so the best way to avoid that, like any recipe, your favorite cocktail, your favorite cookies, follow the steps to the mm-hmm. recipe to find the right balance.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Marty in Ellensburg, Washington. Hi, Marty.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I keep killing my worms in my worm bin, and I'm not sure why, but I've ended up with a whole lot of dried up worm tea, and I'm wondering the best way to reconstitute that, to use it, assuming I can.
So when you say worm tea, do you mean that you were feeding your worms some water, a liquid was collecting at the bottom, and that was the worm tea? Is that what you're...
Yeah, the worm tea is all that stuff that collects at the bottom. I never fed them water, but tea, you know, was there.
So here might be some sad news, which is that I know that many of these commercial, like, worm bin things have special spigots or way to collect worm tea. But if your bin
right.
has enough water so that it's... Or, I'm sorry, liquid that it's leaking, you've actually probably overfed them and you haven't found the right balance. And that in itself will create anaerobic conditions. It will create ammonia. It will create odor, and it could make your bin hot. Like, all of these things can kill a worm system. So really,
that's why I keep killing it.
You're excited, right? They're like your pets. You love them. You want to feed them. But that always goes wrong, no matter what kind of pet you have. So really, I am a big advocate of portion control. I think if you start another worm bin, for every pound of worms you get, which is about 1,000 worms, that's like the commercial going rate, right? 1,000 worms. But start with a cup of food at a time and watch. See how quickly they eat it. And once that is almost gone, that is the only point at which you should feed them again.
Good luck to you.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay, but...
You live in New York, and for people with small apartments, having a bin full of worms doesn't sound ideal.
There's
another method you call bokashi.
Oh.
Tell us about bokashi.
So, right, I mentioned bokashi earlier. It is my favorite thing to do right now, and I've actually adapted it in a couple of office spaces and in apartment spaces. And essentially, you're taking a bucket, which is airtight. So unlike the other system we've described, there are no holes for air. And you place layers of food scraps, and this can be any food scrap. It's super forgiving. Your bones, your meat, your dairy, your mystery items at the back of your fridge. And you inoculate them layer by layer at a time with special, like, dry material that's been inoculated with a collection of EM1, which is effective microbes, Formula 1. It's some lactobacillus. It's some phototropic bacteria and yeasts. And this special, like, trifecta of microbes does amazing work to ferment that food waste, which you can then bury in any soil system, like in a local garden or in your backyard.
Mm. I'm Ira Flato. This is Science Friday from PRI Public Radio International. Learning almost all there is to know about composting with Rebecca Louis, author of Compost City, Practical Composting Know-How for Small Space Living. It seems to me how amazing people are lighting up the phones with talking about this.
I love it.
I mean, let me see if I can get one more call or two in there. Jeff in Broomie, Texas. Hi, Jeff. Bernie,
that's right. Hi. I'm an avid home brewer, and when you make a batch of beer, you're left with about a 2-quart yeast cake on the bottom when you pour the wort off and it becomes beer. My question is, I've been pouring that in my compost pile. It just seems like it would be a lot of microbes, and I'm wondering if there's any added benefit, or do you know, to my compost pile?
And the compost pile is outdoors, I assume?
That is correct.
Yeah. I think it should be good. I don't have specific experience with brewing yeast cakes, but the organic element is fantastic. You know, people put all sorts of things in their compost bin. Like, some people do urine. There's a whole, like, humanure movement. And essentially, as long as the organic materials that you're mixing into your pile are complemented with the right amount of, like, dry materials, for example, again, the carbons, the leaves, et cetera, and you find balance, you should be good to go.
All right. Thanks for calling. Can you put, how shall I put it, dog poop into your compost?
So you can. And, you know, the digester, which is sort of the submerged system that I mentioned earlier, is a great way to compost your dog poop. I wouldn't mix it into any piles that have any intention of being anywhere around edibles. Obviously, dog feces can have certain, like, parasites to consider. So hot composting, which happens, like, if you find this kind of very specific ratio of, like, volume and mass, et cetera, will kill off pathogens. But it's something that can be done. So these doggy digesters, where you just basically throw it into, like, a tube in the soil, become quickly populated with earthworms and such that want to break it down.
How do you keep it going over the wintertime, your pile outside?
So keeping it going over the wintertime isn't so much a thing if you've got, like, real winter. You know, like all science, when temperatures drop, microbes slow down. The reason why bokashi, again, is attractive is that because you're fermenting in a bucket, it can be indoors and anywhere, and come springtime, the fermentation has occurred over the set period of time, so you can be good to go starting spring and then collect in buckets over the winter. Similarly, a system like a worm bin, which is easily, like, kept in your home, in the closet, under the sink, under your bed, is a good way to keep it going as well, because temperatures are regulated.
All right, Rebecca, thank you very much for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome. Rebecca Louis is founder of the blog Compost S and author of Compost City, Practical Composting Know-How for Small Space Living. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, ancient ungulates Grizzly bear suits is the topic of our latest video about the musk ox, how to sneak up on a musk oxen herd and survive to tell the tale. We'll tell you about the guy who does that for a living, and Lou Gretzkin will be here. He went along and made the video. We'll talk about it after this break. Stay with us. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Believe it or not, there are some species of animals that scientists still know very little about. And I'm not talking about some tiny insect in the Amazon. I'm talking about big mammals right here in the U.S. For instance, the musk ox is an ancient ungulate, you know, an animal with hooves, that have thrived in remote areas of Alaska for centuries. But as we know, the Arctic environment is changing rapidly, and scientists don't know how the musk ox will fare in a warmer climate. But how do you get to know a rarely seen animal living in a remote part of the world? Well, you could view these animals from an airplane or perhaps capture and tag some of them to study. But my next guest prefers a different method, something more unconventional, shall we say. He dresses up like their natural predator, a grizzly bear. It's like that old saying, if you can't beat him, join him. And joining me now is Joel Berger, a senior scientist for the Wildlife Conservation Society and Cox Chair of Wildlife Conservation at Colorado State University. And Joel's work with the musk ox is the subject of a new macroscope video produced by our own Luke Groskin, who also joins me today. Welcome back, Luke.
Hi, Ira.
Joel, for those of us who haven't seen the video on our website yet, can you start by telling us what the musk ox looks like?
So, hi, Ira.
Hi there.
Hi, Luke. Hey. So musk ox are the largest polar land animal in the world. They're big, about three-quarters the size of a bison. They have long, draping hair. People know that they roamed with woolly mammoths, and so they have that kind of an appearance. Long, draping hair, cold-adapted. They live in herds.
They live in herds. Look, you met up with Joel in a remote part of Alaska to film his research. What was that like?
Oh, it was pretty surreal. I mean, in order to just meet up with Joel out there, we had to connect with him with GPS and figure out coordinates. We had to go out for an hour and a half on snow machines, snowmobiles, and it was cold, and it was a bit of an adventure. And so we're out there in the middle of nowhere, and Joel rides up with his research partner, Dr. Alan Chang, and just to be clear, he kind of looks like Buffalo Bill Cody, but in Patagonia. That's how I would describe how Joel looks.
Central casting from us.
He's very unassuming. He just comes up and says, hey, Luke, nice to meet you. And let's go see some musk oxen. We just went off from there. It was a very surreal experience.
Well, Joel, tell us, the way you go about studying them, as I mentioned, is the most interesting aspect. Describe how you do that.
So the central goal is to get inside the mind of a musk ox, and it's like, how do you know what they're thinking? And you don't. And so what you try to do is break their visual field, and you can do that by looking like a musk ox. But in this case, we're interested in how they respond to grizzly bears, because grizzly bears are expanding their range into some of the Arctic islands. And so I dress up as a grizzly bear and approach on all fours to understand whether the herd is going to get scared, whether they recognize I'm a threat, whether they're going to stay and defend themselves, whether they're going to turn coat, not literally, but run.
So describe what you look like. Do you have a cape over you? You dress, what is it? What do you look
like?
Okay,
so I've got like a Davy Crockett cape that's draped over most of my body. I'm wearing a little day pack, so I have a hump on my back, just like a grizzly bear has a hump, and I'm crawling on all four. And for my head, I have a styrofoam bear head, and I use that to navigate. And with Luke Groskin's help, we put a GoPro camera on it, and so as I'm approaching, we're also looking through the eyes of the GoPro, trying to get a sense, are these musk oxen scared? Are males more likely to charge? Are females likely to run? What about the young ones in their group? And so we're gauging their response.
Yeah. So, Luke, take it from here. You saw firsthand how this is.
Well, actually, I'm going to back up just a second, because you can't just walk up to a herd of musk oxen way off in the distance. You got to you got to strategize, and you know, Joel's very good about that. He's trying to figure out, okay, so if we go around on this side of the mountain, then maybe they won't see us. So we climb up a hill mountain, we get up there, and all of a sudden Joel just kind of drops down onto his and slides down the mountain back towards us really dramatically. He's like, "Get down, get down, get down," whispering. And he comes up to us and he kind of explains the situation.
The animals are right there. So as soon as the bear pops over, they're going to split. Usually they don't run, but they're going to split.
And of course, in the back of my head, I was like, no, that can't happen. We definitely need to get this. But he's an expert. He's a pro. We trust him. He gets dressed up, and then he approaches. And I was just kind of amazed with how there's a method to this. This is not just, you know, a man dressed up in a bear costume approaching muskox. And he's very specifically, he knows when the mature bull in the group is eyeballing him. And there's a level of safety that he has and awareness that he has that I definitely did not have.
Joel, why is it so easy to fool a muskox with just a, don't they smell you versus see you, you know, your costume?
So they might smell me, and as you know, Ira, the name of the show is Science Friday, and so if we're all putting on our science hats, I need a control, and that control is a caribou, and so I have a fake caribou, and so the smell is the same. You know, I'm kind of stinky because I haven't had a shower, and I've been living up in the Arctic for a while, and there's no running water.
That's true.
And so the muskox are getting, you know, Joel Berger, no matter what they're doing. But the other thing that they're getting is a difference. They're getting a caribou and they're getting a grizzly bear.
Wow. And so they
at different times.
So if they got ornery at you and decided to charge, what do you do then, Joel?
That's been an issue. I'm dealing with permits. And for me to get my permits, I pretty much have to assure that I'm going to be safe because they don't want both the state of Alaska and the U.S. government don't want an idiot in a musk in a grizzly bear suit getting killed. And so basically I carry a whistle, but that's not necessarily effective. I carry pepper spray, but when it's 0 or -5 or -10 out and the wind is blowing, pepper spray doesn't work. A gun is stupid because we're not there to shoot animals. But the one thing that works is if I self-detonate and the cape goes in one direction, the head goes in the other, and I stand up, the muskox, if they're charging, get very confused, and then I'm safe.
So just by taking off your costume, they see, oh, it's no longer a grizzly bear. It's a person. Do they know where the person is?
Well, I'm still here, Iron, so that's a good sign.
Were you a little scared, Luke, when this started going on? Any fear or trepidation about doing this?
I was more concerned that they would get spooked, and then when Joel finishes that, he gets photometric data. He gets actual photos of them. And that part of the kind of experiment, he told us to kind of go around on the other side, and then the muskoxen won't run that way. That was the only part where I was a little bit like, uh-oh, wait, I'm moving away from you now. But I was never really kind of scared for him. The only thing, there was a little part of me, though, that was in the back of my head being like, what would happen if a bear came by right now? Like, what would happen then? I mean, that sounds a little bit scary, but the chances of that happening are very, very slim.
Well, and the best news on that is the mating season is not until June, and we were there in March.
So they would the bulls be protective if you were there then in the mating season?
Well, I was thinking about the bear, you know, the bear being interested in us.
Luke talked about the data and taking pictures. What kind of pictures are you taking? What kind of data are you collecting?
Okay, so good question. So the broader picture that we're interested in is how climate change is affecting a cold-adapted species. And so just as scientists measure tree rings to look at growth, we're measuring the head sizes of young muskoxen, 1, 2, and 3-year-olds, so we can look incrementally at how different kind of weather events affect the growth and how that occurs across time. So we're photographing animals, just like if you have a 2-year-old baby, a 4-year-old baby, and a 6-year-old, you can measure their head sizes, and you can figure out how normally they grow, but then if there are different or traumatic events, like they go without food for 2 months or a mother is not lactating. So that's why we're doing it, getting the head sizes and measuring them digitally on a computer.
So you come back to the same herd. Is it right to call them a herd?
It is right, yeah. And we developed these profiles. We've done this in the Arctic, Alaskan Arctic for 9 years. And we've also done this in the Russian Arctic for 2 out of the last 3 years.
How did you get into this line of work?
I grew up in L.A., and...
Well, that makes sense.
And I needed a different way to look at the world, and so I left L.A.
It's that simple, huh?
No, life is not simple. We know that. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
And so how do you get training in this work to do this?
I did a postdoc at Smithsonian Institution. I did my PhD in Colorado. And then I spent a lot of time on different continents working with very talented scientists, looking at different ways to understand how we do conservation and bring the natural world into something of relevance in our world. Mm.
Our number 844-724-8255 if you'd like to talk about these guys out there with the musk oxen. But you also, I understand, Joel, there are other animals that you study the same way.
We worked on rhinos in Namibia and in Zimbabwe. I've worked on bison in North America. We've done some work in Central Asia with wild yaks and an endangered antelope called saiga. So, yeah, I've been able to have some opportunities in life to work in different parts of the world on spectacular species.
Mm-hmm. I'm Ira Flato. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Talking with Joel Berger and Luke Raskin. Joel is a senior scientist for the Wildlife Conservation Society and Cox Chair of Conservation Biology at Colorado State University. Luke, you've gone to a lot of different places, filmed a lot of stuff. How does this rate go? You had to get on an airplane, and this was not an easy place to get to, was it?
This was a real... I mean, getting out to see these animals is a real adventure. You can't... especially in the winter, I mean... Riding a snowmobile for 10 hours when you've never actually ridden one before is it's not just sitting back.
You definitely,
yeah, it's backbreaking, and you gain a real respect for the biologists and the park workers and the people that are out there studying these animals, because it's cold, it's uncomfortable, and they don't come. They usually are staying in outdoors or in limited shelter in very, very, very cold conditions. And, yeah, they're doing it. It's pretty impressive.
Joel, is there a hunting season or any hunting allowed?
The state of Alaska has some offtake of musk ox for subsistence use, meaning meat. And at one point, they allowed more males to be harvested than females, but the state was very prudent and conservative, and so they've cut back on some of that as well.
In case you're just joining us, we're talking with Joel Berger and Luke Raskin on Science Friday from PRI Public Radio International. Luke, let's talk about the video.
Sure.
It's an exciting video. I've seen it already. It's got great music. It's got great. It's got drama.
Sure.
Great drama. I'm not quite sure what I'm going to see, you know?
Well, I mean, the musk oxen themselves are kind of the stars of it. And, you know, I found out about this species a long time ago. And when you see them, they look like these big, dramatic animals. And they're super charismatic because they really do look like they don't belong in the modern era. They look like they're from the Ice Age. And it's just impressive to me that they've made it this far. And I wanted to meet up with the guy that studies them.
Joel, you describe the musk ox as an ancient species. Is there, I mean, how, when you say ancient, what does that mean?
Well, so the musk ox goes back several hundred thousands of years. They actually went extinct in Alaska in the 1890s, and the state brought them back, and now they're doing reasonably well in a couple of National Park Service units where I work. One is called Bering Land Bridge, the other is called Cape Krusenstern, named after a Russian naval officer. But they're doing okay now, but they're unchanged from what they were a quarter of a million years ago.
Mm-hmm. It's got a couple of interesting calls. Let's go to South Bend, Indiana. Randy, hi, welcome to Science Friday.
Hi.
Hi there. Go ahead.
I'm wondering if you studied the herd of musk ox that tends to cause some havoc in the town of Nome.
Okay.
Have you?
So the town of Nome is where there are a lot of musk ox that roam actually near the runway, the airport, and also near where there are 4,000 people. And we've looked at them there, but we haven't focused on them there. Mm-hmm. So that's the simple answer.
Let's go to Palmer, Alaska, to William. William, welcome to Science Friday.
Yeah, hi. Back in 1929, my dad came to Fairbanks to go to college, and his summer job with another fellow was protecting the musk ox herd because they weren't fenced in. And the job entailed camping out by the musk ox herd and shooting a bear anytime the bear would try to get in and kill the calves. And as he explained it, the problem was that if a bear could break the circle, because when they were threatened, they would circle up facing out. And if a bear could get in the center, they wouldn't just kill a calf. They would kill every calf they could get a hold of. And the problem was it would set back the herd a whole generation. So the university paid them to camp out during the summer and shoot bears if the bears got in a position to threaten the herd. And then they would take turns going into town for supplies every week and just move their camp as the herd moved. And
Lost them there. Have you heard about that, Joel? Was that a common practice?
I think at that point it was. It's not today, but certainly we know bears can be good predators, and the muskox live in these defensive social herds for a reason.
Are you sensitive, Joel, to the political debate over what is essential research, that this might look like something a congressperson could point out and say, look what our tax dollars are paying for, studying muskox?
I'm quite sensitive to that, yes. I've thought a bit about it.
And your reaction?
My reaction is very straightforward. To think about the fact that we have more people who visit national parks every year, something like 280 million people. That's more than all baseball, football, and basketball combined. We have more people who go to zoos every year than all professional sports. The same for museums. And so when we look at the fabric of America and America's dedication to wildlife and wildlife conservation and wildlife viewing, we know that it's important in our society. Mm-hmm. And if we can understand animals better and we can do conservation better, we know that it's not just for the animals, but we're all part of the same world.
That's a great way to sum it up. Joel Berger, senior scientist for the Wildlife Conservation Society, Cox Chair of Wildlife Conservation, Colorado State University, and Luke Groskin, Science Friday video producer. Thank you both.
Thank you, Ira.
And if you want to see my guest, Joel Berger, dressed up as a grizzly in the name of science, you can check out Luke's video. It's on our website. Head over to sciencefriday.com/muskox. That's spelled M-U-S-K-O-X. sciencefriday.com/muskox. One last thing before we go. Help Science Friday prepare for the solar eclipse this summer, by completing a short quiz at sciencefriday.com/survey. That's sciencefriday.com/survey. A total eclipse of the sun, very rare. We'd like to know what you think. PJ Lederman composed our theme music. Our thanks to our production partners at the studios of the City University of New York. Have a great weekend. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.